Mr. Waller, Reel 9. You were talking about the Koreans, and these last people that you mentioned were, what were the names?
The Porter people were the porters who did for you. And then there was a command came down through the Div that all units in the Commonwealth Div would have what I call educated Koreans attached. And now we had 12 in the signal platoon. I mean, I don't know what they had in the other companies, but I would think the ratio is the same. But for educated Koreans, well, they've left a lot to the imagination if they were educated. And we got, they got issued with rifles, and they were all greased. And they had one chap which said, what you do is you put a fire in the barrel, you see, and then you turn the barrel so the grease gets hot and you drop up and it can clean it up. And they had one or two rifles just shoved in butt first to where, you know, we lost them through that. You had to be reissued. But they were happy people. They all seemed happy to me. I know we had a little bit of friction because you've always got, I think, well, we can call it racism now, but I think that's what it was. At 19, I didn't know about racism. But one or two of the lads in the platoon had gone among these Koreans and they beat one or two up. I don't know what that was for, whether it was just to show they were, the whites were so prim or not, but they said, look, we want two people to go and stop in this tent with these Koreans. So I said, well, I'll go for one. And the chap I was mates with from South Church, he said, let's from Australia this morning. He went in with us.
And his name was?
Arthur Tinsdale. And we already had this set of dominoes from the mayor of Durham. We used to play dominoes on the night. And we got these Koreans invested in it. So they wanted to play dominoes on the night. And we always played for a cigarette. So I didn't smoke, but Arthur did. And we had these Koreans. But at the end of our tour there, when we were saying farewell nearly to them people, the gambling bugger hit them that bad. These 50 cigarettes we got on a Thursday, they would put them all in the middle, turn the dominoes over, and there was 12 of them, and they went and pulled the highest domino, but all the cigarettes, you got 12 tins of cigarettes. I always remember that about them, but you treated them as equal, and they would do anything for it. I don't think, from the day I went into that tent, and you called them happy, and we only had one there that was a wrong one. But they did your washing for you. Let me do that, Johnny. If I know how to do that. You show me how to do this, you show me how to do that. But we had one of them with a school teacher. And he used to say on the night, you know, I didn't ask you, British, to come here. I want you to go home. And I think he agitated through the day, but in the end, he just said to the Korean people, whoever they were, we've got a man here, he's a bit of a pacifist. And I remember when he came with him, there was four military police came for him in their jeep. And he was in our lockup in the nick, and the provost sergeant brought him out. And the first thing he did was just let him go out with a stick and throw him in the jeep and hope he'd going down the line. And I think he would be dead before he got to where he was going to. I don't think he would have lived. He didn't want any pacifists, he had to fight, it was his own country. But I only met that one. And
was that the only time you saw any ill treatment to them?
Well, no. When we first went to Korea, when we were in, as we call it, Chestnut Grove, which you see on television a lot now with children, you're not used to this sort of thing. And we had these porters who were doing kitchen duties, you know. When you finished your meal, you were in a tent with dressing tables and a bench with five or six of you, and you went to the end to a drum and you just scraped everything off. And it was outside, it was beside a little stream. And I remember this, and they must have known there was, when everybody had finished, there was a crowd of boys, little ones and big ones, I would say from maybe four, six up to about 12 or 14 came, and the barrel was knocked over and they were there. And these porters came out with pickshafts and they were just chasing them away all the, you know, the time. That stuck in my mind all the time. And when you talk sometimes to the lads that were there, so can you remember that? Oh, you never forget it. Then you see it more now with the television, with all the world, the children that suffer. We know that.
The men that you described that were with you, had they come to your particular unit, and obviously others, to learn how to work signals or whatever, or did they have a task?
I don't know what they came for, actually. I don't know they were supposed to be the educated ones. I mean, they were, a stick of this table top. He would take you a duty, and there was one occasion, he said, right, take these two down there, and dig that brain pit there. So you were digging away, and you found a route. Oh, throw the spear to one side, and said, come on, what's that? No. And he did. And breakfast, you'd go for breakfast, you've got two slices of bread, a square egg, because they used to cook about 40 eggs at a time on a tray. This egg just fitted this slice of bread nicely. And then they would put the pottage on top of that, put the other slice of bread on that, and so on. So, educated.
Were they Korean Army personnel, or...?
They were a army personnel, but they were issued with the same uniform. We got the same uniform, and they had to wear a green beret, and they wore the DLI badge as well. Oh, they were very proud to be... I don't remember them doing the marching. They could have done, because they would have to parade the same as us. But I can never remember seeing them on a parade anywhere. The photographs I've seen, there's no groups, as they called them, whether they were porters or whether they were attached to us, with CATCOMs, Koreans attached to the Commonwealth Division, that's what it was. But I enjoyed my time with them lads, and, you know, I was interested in wrestling, and we used to have wrestling a night. Carrying on. No, you know, I didn't see any harm in that, you see. And I really enjoyed my time with the CATCOMs.
But as you've intimated, they were very cruel towards their own kind.
Well, they would be. Like, I think you did hear people say, well, he's a North Korean, him, but when he came down here and he got caught and he said he was a good boy, so he's come to work for us, like, you know. But they all look the same to you, they don't know the difference. Was it North Korean or not? I mean, there was one or two. I mean, he used to wrestle and he used to throw me all over because I was too late. But he used to wrestle someone on and off the same way as you would wrestle Cumberland style, where you put your hands on it. Well, he used to shoulder to shoulder, grab one ankle and the belt. And it was the same idea, you had to put the man down. And we used to have a go every night. I think I did it once, maybe. So I got him off the bottom once. But otherwise, he just threw me all over. But I used to enjoy it. And,
were you warned about infiltration from North Koreans?
Oh, yes. Well, you used to get the newspapers. On the radio, if you heard them, you know, you would get from the offices of AP, UP, Associated Press, International Press, and the UPI, United Press International. I still have some bits of newspapers, you know, with these. And then he would, that was the American issue with their news of the war in Korea. Then we used to get what we called the Crown News, was the one from our people that told you what was going on. And you'd find little incidents in there. there's a border team going 6 miles behind the lines, and the sergeant's coming back from somewhere, so well, I don't remember them. I better get the plug out. And he find out that there's North Korean infiltration. They've come in behind with the borders and he's going to do a bit of damage. We used to get them, the odd one or two. But they were very stingy. Now, I think Colonel Jeffries was a very good CEO, that he wanted to keep everybody right. He didn't want to have any casualties unnecessarily. And the defensive positions for mines and wire, I think, was very, very good. That anybody coming up there was going to be in a bit of bother from the infiltrators. But you did see them when you were going out on line duties, you would see them wandering about. And that's what I said before. They would say, well, I don't like the look of him, so pull the cock the piece so he could hear it, march. And then let the interpreter get at him and see. And a lot of times, well, this is my land, I work here, I still want to work it. Even though there's a war on, and it's that simple. But the agriculture, I came from an agricultural background, and you would see them ploughing with an ox, and like a wooden plough. And if it broke, well, they just went and got another tree and started to carve another piece to fit on it and carry on. But they were so primitive, and they were so... They didn't want any invaders there. They just didn't understand what was going on.
You were in this rest and reserve position for about 2 or 3 weeks. Then you moved back again on the same hill.
Before
Christmas, and then I think it was October that
Yeah, in October, and we came out. Maybe it was November, was it? I don't know. We were in 3 weeks or a month in the line.
And then back to the same hill, according to the records, for a short spell.
I'd gone to Bay Echelon over the Christmas period. Then I was in Bay Echelon.
Can we look at Christmas? What was the entertainment or the festivities for as regards your Christmas?
Christmas in the line. If it was, I don't think it was in the line at Christmas.
I think you're out the line. Yes.
It was out the line. So it would be the same as it is for the 5th of November, which is Inkerman Day. That the officers and the sergeant major would have to come round and get you out of bed with a cup of tea, and fetch you the beer and provide you with your Christmas dinner and everything. You see, I don't remember that in the. I was at Bay Echelon, and we were sat at the trestle table in there, and they were supplied by Major Flanagan came round, and there would be another lieutenant, and then there was the quartermaster Calvert, he was the QM's company sergeant major sort of thing, and they did the supplying of the beer and the turkey or whatever it was. There was an interesting point I made about the MT section. A lad called Norman Hyman, he shot a deer, and the MT section had venison for their Christmas dinner as I understand it.
But it was a typical Army Christmas, in effect.
Oh, typical Army Christmas, yes. Yes, and then you were...
Singing carols, and did you sing songs?
Well, I would think you would, because you'd have your beer. I mean, there was a lad there, he was chief clerk for the battalion, and I went to school with him, you see, so I was in the good company there with him. We had to talk about home, and he went to school with us both, and my wife as well. But yes, it wasn't a bad time there. But, I did find out I've always been a trusting sort of person. It doesn't happen so much now, but if I wear a watch, I fling my arms about on a night and I end up breaking them. So I used to take this watch off and a G1098 issue, because you had to be right for you. Use the radio back to the HQ or the telephone, and that. And I took it off this one night, and the lad in the next bed stole it. And I had to go in front of Colonel Jeffers, and he charged me 15 shillings for losing the army watch. And it must have been 3 weeks later, a sergeant had seen this chap wearing this watch, and he said to him, "Where did he get that?" And he said, "Oh, I found it." "Well, we'll just have the number off it." So I took the number off it, and he reported it, and it turned out it was the number of the one that I had watched. Lost. But he'd been the person that cleaned everything, and he burnt all these things in he was the official waste gatherer for the section where we were in the echelon, and he burnt, and he found these bits of pieces and said, "Oh, there's your watch, you've lost it, it's gone out." And then he got time for that. I don't know if they went to Seoul for it, but for stealing your mate's equipment, they don't like you very much. They never came back to the echelon, mate.
Now, was there much stealing in the unit?
I don't know. I don't remember any, apart from the watch and one occasion some clothing went missing. But I think we'd be selling that for beer money, like that's there. But you see, all these things come out in these magazines later when other people are reciting them. Well, I didn't know that. No, I think in a lot of cases, that's what they'd be selling the gear for beer money, really.
So you moved to B Echelon around the Christmas or after Christmas time?
Well, I had Christmas dinner there, yes. I was there for a month.
What was your duty? What were you doing there?
The telephone was to move from the QM's office to his tent on a night, and then from there on the morning, you only had one telephone, so then he'd take it from there and put it in his tent on a night and put it in the office on the morning. I had a radio which I had to operate on a night, and took nothing called B. You might have to call BHQ, you see, to say what they wanted or the supply thing. I didn't use it all that much because the telephone wires worked well. I don't remember using it a lot. It only was once a day just to talk to them, just to keep the line open, you see. The difficult part about it was, I had my hook, she was on the side of the hill. I don't know what I should tell you, this is really embarrassing, this next episode. And the telephone, the area for the radio set was sketched between two trees. And he had a little wire where he dropped across like that on a thumbscrew, and he tied up three different sections of wire, 25 foot, 50 foot, 75 foot, 100 foot. If you couldn't get through, you would extend it to longer range. And I walked this poor one night down this extension, and I slipped. And I came down, and I sat on this Japanese beer bottle, and it went right up the rectum. And I said to his friend of mine, I've sat on a bloody Japanese bottle, bath, and the bloody blood's pouring out of here. And he used about three of these packs that you had, you know, your bandage on the side, to stop the bleeding. But I remember he said, well, I've got the film now, we want to take your photograph on the 38th panel, which was just close by. I said, well, I want to be able to say, no, I'll leave them on. And when I came back from this photograph session, these denim trousers were soaked. And I just stepped straight out of them. They were sort of just stood up right on their own. Another funny thing about them denim trousers, they were made at the clothing factory at West London.
But you weren't hospitalised, were you?
No, I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't go sick or anything. And when I came out, I still haven't, you know, we have a good laugh about it, really, about the war world. I did have a little bit of trouble with it. When I was constipated, it used to swell up, and I had to go to the doctor's a time or two. I just got an injection, and luckily, I mean, over the years, I've never had no bother with it. But,
Can you describe B Echelon to me? What exactly was B Echelon?
It was a supply, the supply unit. They had a stores, which was clothing. There was a big area, really, because across this little bit here was a big Australian supply depot, and they supplied a lot of the material, the foodstuffs that went into these sea rations. So I begin to think maybe the sea rations were, they would be American, or they may have been supplied by the Americans. They did supply most of the equipment and the stuff over there. But that was a big warehouse there, and that went on fire one night, a big tent, really. But they had the stores, they had tradesmen, there were joiners, carpenters, painters. There was a whole conglomerate, I would think, of people who were specialists. I mean, if anybody had a casualty, he came back to the Echelon, and one lad there had to do all the details and sew them up before they went to Seoul on the journey to Port Sandwich. He had to be done there.
So that was like the regimental aid post was there for the initial
The aid post was at BHQ. At B Echelon, you came, they brought you in a wagon. It just used to be with the bodies, if you had any casualties. The wagon used to come round and you'd open the flap at the back and the racks were there with the bodies on, whichever. He just like a supply man, you've got two guys, just take them out.
These are the dead. These are the dead lads.
Yes. And the other lad there, his job was to put them in the, wrap them up and stitch them up, you see, ready for them to go to be buried when he went to Pearl Sam. There also was, you always had signs to be made, did signs, and we had two painters, well, one painter, I think. How the hell he went to the DLI, I don't know, but the painter, he was immaculate. I don't know if you've ever seen any of a lot of the paintings by somebody called Prophet. But he just used to get a postcard like that of all the cathedrals, and he used to turn a great big picture up like that. Well, he was immaculate, he was. Committed suicide a few years ago. But his glasses were like that.
askew on his face.
His shirt will be fastened over, his tie's round here, his boat braces were always undone, and never had any putties on, his one trouser would be up there somewhere. But with these, and the immaculate.
It's painting.
Oh, it was profit, yes. And there was a lad called Ken Burt. He was very good freehand painting, and he used to do all sorts of painting and gift to him. A friend at York there, he has one now on his little study done by this lad. Then they had the washing place as well. They had the wishy-washy. There was two Korean ladies that did the washing. I don't know where they did it at, I can't remember. But they used to have big vats and fires and so forth, and Korean porters there to help them. I say they had the ration trucks used to go out. Ken McGuffey from Sunderland was a ration corporal, and they would ring up, you say, ring the KOMs and say, we want boxes of this and boxes of that, and he would go around, and then he'd have to, maybe he'd have to go to the place over here that somebody else had and get whatever he wanted, you see. But that was the BX one, was the big stores part of it. You rang them and you wanted something, and they supplied it.
And you were, the, in effect, the signaller to
BX? Well, I was the signaller there, but we used to charge the batteries for the lights and the tents on the night. And I was there, you charged the batteries for the radio, your own radio, and for the other tents, you see. Well, you just had electric light. You couldn't go on the big marquee and stick cameras up, so we had electric light too.
How far would B echelon be away from the battalion position?
Well, I said anywhere between 5 and 10 miles. I could be out, I don't know of that. But you see, you also had an A echelon in between. Now, I don't know what the A echelon did at all. They would have the MT section there at the A echelon. That's about it. I can't remember everything else about it. I never went to Echelon. You maybe got to come back there for a shower sometimes or have a day's rest at the Echelon. Can't remember really. I know you used to get a ride out in the wagon, and it used to be a kind of little ride, and you got a shower and a change of clothing, and then you could go and read the papers, and before it was time to go back to the battalion, or to, you know, to wherever you were. But then you also got 5 days rest recuperation in Tokyo.
At what point in time did you get the one? You got one, presumably.
About the April, I think.
Well, we'll come to that, because we're around about Christmas at the moment,
yes,
aren't we?
Yeah. But I was at B echelon then for the Christmas period. I had Christmas dinner there. I do remember what somebody else had said to me. The party newspaper had been out there, and we'd been round the organ singing carols and one thing and another. And somebody back here had seen it on the newsreel at the cinema somewhere, so the story's come down. I mean, nobody told me about it, it's all here, so that I've got.
So you said the B echelon was lit by electricity, so
No, at that far back...
It
wasn't electricity, it was all battery.
No, so battery, yes. So that far behind the lines, there wasn't blackouts, anything like that? It was lit up pretty well, was it?
Well, the thing is that from there, they didn't have any aeroplanes to bother us, you see. I mean, apart from, there used to be one old aeroplane used to fly around. I mean, I've heard it a time or two, and I heard them say he would be flying over the front. It just was nuisance value. That's all it was. And I think it just was an old single engine thing going too slow for these jet people to catch them, really. It was going that slow. But you still have to come and throw a few engineers out, that was just to be a nuisance value.
But as you said, there was no aircraft on the other side at all.
No,
complete air superiority.
The one thing about the possibly before they came out of the line at Christmas, that he would have gone to bed on the night and you got up the next morning, and on the wire, away from, not very far from you, the Chinese had been, and they'd put their sweets on and Christmas cards and things like that. You couldn't get all, you didn't know you'd have to touch it in case they were bogey trapped. But you got a lot of cards. I'm getting them now for Christmas. Somebody puts them through a photocopy to get them as a Christmas card.
But you didn't see this. This was
no, I was up in the front. It's just the front line, lads, and lads that were really up the sharp end, as you might say.
And you said you were with BS for about a month?
I was there about a month, yes. The signal platoon did a rotor system. Somebody else went down there to do that. I mean, I was there about the Christmas period. Then I came back to the battalion and did a bit of line duty. And then I went on a course to... there's a battery charging course because we were going under 24... You were on 24 hours and you were off 24 hours. You had to know what we were doing, you see. It's no good being neatly busy with the Corporal Kenny knew what was going on, but there was a three-day course, I think it was, and it was to learn to solder wires on aerials. We had a 31 set, which had an aerial where they just slip into each other, but you had to have one end soldered up to stop it pulling right out. So I went to learn to solder, and learned to charge batteries, where you've got a battery and you tip the acid out and you mix the acid, you put the water first or the acid first. If you put it the wrong way around, the bottle fell out of the glass, and you had all this to do. But this was a Commonwealth, you know. There was Canadians, there was our own troops, there was Royal Scots, there were Black Watch, Royal Fusiliers. I was mates with the 3rd Australian Regiment lad. There was Maoris, all these rugby men, you know, 30 men on the side coming out of the mess of the night, and two or three rugby balls up there. You're looking at them like that, and one of these Maoris hit you, and they were built like a tank to start with, they were flattened. I didn't fancy rugby at all.
What were the Australians like? How did you find them?
Big, brash, boastful, but brilliant. I loved them. Well, I loved the accent. The one I was friendly with, a lad called Richardson, he'd been in the desert during the First World War, he was a pilot of some sort, but he got sand behind his eyes. But these were all volunteers. I think a lot of the Canadians were volunteers as well. And when he used to take his hat off, his hair used to stand straight up. And he's the only Australian I've ever heard admit his grandfather was a convict. But he said, he came across, his great-grandfather was a convict. But he had steel grey hair, he just used to go straight up for about 3 inches.
Do you remember his name?
Richardson, he called him. And rough, we were out one night, must be going to a cinema, and he came back and he had two tins, I think, of his pot noodles. And he just tipped them into this pint jug, and he got a bottle of tomato sauce, he just broke it off like that and put it in and stirred it up, and he never took the pot down till it had all gone.
Canadians, were they
Canadians? Some of the Canadians were alright, but I don't know where we came in contact with the Canadians. I think they were next to us at one time, and their bugle section used to come through our BHQ for their practice. And our bugles are a short one, but their bugles are a long one like this. And you could hear them, and you used to swing it when you do the bugle practice in the morning, and they would give you a little bit of the big band sound, but they would swing it, or they were great to listen to. They were absolutely great. The Van Doos were the French speaking, and they were very, very rough and very, very... I don't think anybody liked them at all. They always, whether they had a chip on the shoulder, but no, they weren't very pleasant people at all. They were really nasty. I only knew one, and he was a horrible person.